join me in attitude,
meditation, and prayer. We are new to this planet. Our species has been around for but a blink of an eye in cosmic time. Our vision, like our wisdom, has grown but slowly as we try to figure out our way in a world without directions, without clear markers along the dimly lit path. We stand on the shoulders of the generations of courageous men and women who have blazed the trail for us and led us to this place, this time, this crossroads. Let us always remember that those who will come after us will stand on our shoulders and will see with our eyes, our dreams, and our vision. May we make our path broad and clear, and may our light illuminate a way that is straight and true for those future travelers, that they might think of us as we would think of our forebears, with thanks, humility, and kindness. I was listening to Hillary introduce me, and it's kind of hard to believe that it's been more than 20 years since I first started getting up in the pulpit, and I never forget what a privilege it is. I have always been a really big science fiction fan. I even wrote and published some way back in the dark ages of the 1970s when I lived up in New Jersey and was attending Montclair State College. It was, I think, in my last year at Montclair State when a friend of mine from school named Carl asked me if I wanted to go to a big science fiction and fantasy convention up in Great Gorge, New Jersey, a ski resort up in the Pocono Mountains. I loved going to science fiction conventions, and this one looked fantastic with lots of big-name writers, a terrific program, and a fantastic dealer's room. This science fiction convention had it all. And what was more, it was going to be held at the Playboy Club. What better place for a science fiction and fantasy convention? Anyway, I told Carl that it would be great to go to the convention, so we made arrangements to drive up together, and we waited for the big day. Well, it was the middle of winter, back when we still had winter, and the night before the convention, it snowed something like 3 feet. The drifts were up over the parked cars on my street. But I was a really big science fiction fan, and so I dug out my car and drove up to college to meet Carl. I didn't for one second doubt that Carl would be there, and so I was not surprised when he was, although his was the only car in sight. He, however, had been a little more practical than I had, and he had called ahead to the Playboy Club to see if the convention was still going to be held. And of course it was, or else he wouldn't have been there. Well, it was still snowing a little, and standing there in the snowdrifts, we had a momentary lapse of faith. But then decided, what the heck? What's the worst thing that could happen? We fall off a mountain road in a blizzard. But, you know, we're all immortal when we're young, so we went off to the convention, driving, I might add, a Ford Pinto. Now, when we had arrived at the convention, the place was deserted. I mean, there was nobody around. But we went into the club, and it was very impressive, and found our way to the auditoriums where the convention was going to be held. When we went inside the auditorium, we saw no more than a dozen fans and a handful of science fiction writers sitting around in conversation. Most of the people present had come in the night before and had stayed at one of the resort hotels. I think Carl and I were the only lunatics who had driven up from the suburbs outside New York City. Anyway, the organizers saw no point to actually conducting the program. Many of their guests of honor hadn't arrived in any event. So we spent the day hanging out in the mostly empty club, talking about science fiction, fantasy, and whatever else was of interest. That was one of my favorite days ever. Yes, I was a geek, and on that day, I was one very happy geek. Just imagine being 21 years old and spending a day with a group of famous science fiction writers and some kindred spirits at a Playboy Club. Now, this is how I met Theodore Sturgeon. How many of you have heard of Theodore Sturgeon? A few, more than in the first service. Theodore Sturgeon was one of the great science fiction writers of the golden age of science fiction, back when John W. Campbell was the editor of Astounding. His most famous novel is More Than Human, which won many awards, and he wrote two of my more favorite Star Trek episodes from the original series, Amok Time and Shore Leave. But on this day, we spent hours talking to each other. We had lunch together, and yes, we had several bunnies as our waitresses, the first and only time that has ever happened to me. And we got to know each other quite well. At some point in the afternoon, he signed the books I had brought up with me, and in the process introduced me to his personal symbol that over the years I have taken as my own. You see, Theodore Sturgeon signed all of his books with his name, and then he added a capital Q with an arrow going through it. Here's what it looks like. Now, he asked me if I knew what that meant, and I said I did not. He then said, and I'll never forget it, and this is, I think, a quote, "It means ask the next question. Ask the next question, and the one that follows that, and the one that follows that, and never stop asking questions." I immediately loved this symbol and what it stood for. I asked a friend who was an art major to make me a stylized Q with an arrow going through it, and I kept it framed on my desk for decades. I have tried to live my life in accordance with the attitude and vision engendered by always being ready and willing to ask the next question and being prepared to accept the answers and where they may lead. This hasn't always been easy, and there is more to it, actually, than meets the eye. Now, asking the next question probably seems to you to be the natural state of affairs. After all, we are Unitarian Universalists. But asking the next question is not a universally embraced attitude about life. There is a distinction between simply asking questions, which is a natural part of being human, and asking the next question. I don't think that asking the next question is actually an inherent part of being human. This is because, and this does make a difference, what most people want is answers. We hate uncertainty. We hate ambiguity. We hate doubt. Human beings want answers so much that we will make them up if we need to. Everything from the great myths that explain the world and our place in it to the guy who says, "I don't know," and then gives you an answer anyway. And once people have those answers and find them psychologically satisfying, they just tend to stop looking. You see, Unitarians always seem to be on the search for truth. That seems to be our creed, if we have one. And when you are searching, it makes sense to ask questions. But what happens when you have found the truth? The natural tendency is to accept what you found, stop asking questions, and settle into a comfortable and satisfying place. Once you have found the truth, people who are still looking, who are still questioning, they have a tendency to annoy you. And so, on the bright side, we can all take some solace that we might annoy them as much as they annoy us. But be that as it may, however, once you've gotten to a place where you are satisfied, it's entirely too easy to stop questioning. And that attitude is understandable. I get that. We all get into our comfort zones with what we know and believe, and we want to stay there. Having certainty, having answers, provides that comfort and lets us relax in a world that is terribly uncertain and is becoming more uncertain every day. Many years ago, I had a secretary who would always interrupt me when we were talking about controversial issues such as abortion, global warming, evolution. She'd tell me that she had her beliefs, that she was satisfied with them, and she was not interested in questioning them. She was saying, "Just leave me alone." The attitude displayed by my secretary can actually be kicked up a notch or two to the point where there is an active ban on asking questions. If you think about the way human beings lived for many centuries in Europe, free inquiry into the way the world worked, how to best live life, and so many other questions that confronted people, that free inquiry was not just discouraged, it was punished. Thus, for a long time, people were told that all they needed to know was Aristotle and the Bible, and any deviation from that script was not just a sin, it was a crime. Now, this sort of attitude is still with us today, of course. The most obvious examples are the fundamentalists in Christianity, Islam, and other religions. But there's more to it than that. At a mundane level, we often hear somebody say, TMI, meaning that they are getting too much information about an uncomfortable or embarrassing subject and they want the speaker to stop. Now, that's a trivial thing. I admit that. It is trivial. But TMI isn't limited to just colonoscopies and locker room stories. TMI is symbolic. It is symbolic of a strong current in our society that discourages inquiry into certain matters and areas of life. From the Frankenstein notion that there are simply things we were not meant to know, to the censorship and burning of books a la Fahrenheit 451, to modern debates about recombinant DNA, stem cells, and cloning, there is a strong current of caution, indeed fear, about asking the next question and pushing the boundaries of knowledge, comfort, and our place in the world. I suspect many of you, reject these notions. You see, for me, asking the next question isn't simply a matter of curiosity. For me, asking the next question is a way of life. It is an approach to the world and how we live in that world that, for me, is the only way to go. Now, of course, many, and by many I mean billions of people, have decided to live their lives and create their futures based on the authority of one of the mainstream religions, and in so doing accept as true and unchanging the values, laws, prescriptions, and choices found in sacred texts as interpreted by priests, rabbis, and mullahs. Those people have their framework of reality, their vision of life, and how to live it, and they are done. They will each tell you sincerely and confidently that their accepted framework is the correct one, be it Christianity, Judaism, Islam, or some other religion. Reason and logic tell us that all of them cannot possibly be correct, but that doesn't seem to matter very much. After all, they will each and every one say that they have faith. Now, faith is supposed to provide answers and with them certainty. It's a kind of forced certainty, although that's rarely acknowledged, because people of faith simply choose to accept something as true. That's the very definition of having faith. Accepting as true those things that otherwise cannot be proved to be true. Faith works, of course, because it provides a safe, certain framework of reality, morality, right and wrong, that people can and do rely upon. And it doesn't seem to matter much what kind of faith we are talking about. Whether it's faith in one of the many religions or faith in a 12-step program, that faith will provide a level of certainty, will itself provide for the comfort, safety, and sense of place and belonging that people seem to require to feel at peace with themselves and their place in the world. This reminds me of a study that I read about many years ago concerning young children and how they respond to their environment. It turns out that if you provide a child with firm and certain boundaries, that child will actually venture out farther in exploring his or her environment than a child that has been given total freedom to do as he or she wishes. Now, this may seem counterintuitive to us as adults, but there is an explanation that makes sense to me. The first child, the ones with the boundaries and the framework, comes from a place of comfort and familiarity, a place of safety and certainty, which provides that child with the confidence and ability to take risks and to venture out a little bit into the world, knowing that if something happens, he or she can always come back to a known and safe place. The second child, The one with complete freedom, however, has no such certainty or safety and experiences what an adult might think of as an unlimited free choice as a frightening chaos. That child must always decide for him or herself what is safe and unsafe, what is good or bad, and how far to go before going too far. This tends to make most children more cautious and anxious about things, and as a result, they tend to hold back some. What applies to children, I would suggest to you, also applies to adults. Now, everybody, whether they have traditional religious faith or not, everybody has a worldview and a view of their place in the world. I have one, Hillary has one, we all have one. That view of the world is the one that we trust, that we act upon, and gives us the same thing that the boundaries gave the young children, a sense of comfort, place, and security in the world. And if we are asking the next question, and the question after that, then we are challenging that view on an almost daily basis, something I think is really difficult to do, but something that I also think is necessary. In this respect, asking the next question symbolizes to me living the responsible, conscious, and intentional life. It is a life with as much responsibility as freedom, and a life marked by having the courage and the will to confront, accept, and address the important questions that challenge us both as individuals and communities. Asking the next question is not so much doubting as it is realizing that most knowledge and most truths are incomplete or inadequate to deal with every situation, especially in our incredibly complex and ever-changing modern world. Yes, it's important to believe in something, truly important, and it is important to be invested in each of our worldviews to the point where we can trust and act upon them. But it is also important to know that they could be wrong and that we may need to change our minds and in the process, change ourselves. Said another way, not only should you not believe everything you hear, but you must be prepared on a moment's notice to not believe everything you think. We are creating ourselves and our futures every day. This requires us to act consciously and with intentionality. That's difficult to do for a variety of reasons, as I've already alluded to, not the least of which is that we have to actually pay attention and steer ourselves and our lives rather than simply letting ourselves follow the path of least resistance or some preordained path chosen by others or the path that our brains urge us to take as a result of evolution and our desire for comfort, certainty, and security. In this regard, asking the next question is a symbol of our ability to rise above the animals that we are, that jumble of instincts, desires, fears, and other programs that evolution has provided to human beings for our survival. Those programs have worked remarkably well, and we have not only survived, we have thrived. But now it's time to change. Those survival techniques, including our incredible propensity for violence and war, as well as our ability to hate and denigrate based on irrational or meaningless distinctions. These techniques simply are not serving us well anymore, and we need to do all in our power to lose them, both personally and as communities and nations. Our ancient myths and mainstream religions contain the strong notion that humans were created by God at the top of the pyramid of life, that God gave people dominion over the earth, and therefore whatever we do is okay. This is a dangerous attitude, and one that needs to be lost along with so much else from our old myths and religions. We need to instead accept that we are a natural part of the natural world, on a par with all life, and that for better or worse, we are the stewards of this planet and need to husband our resources and our home rather than believing that we have permission from God to do whatever we please. There are two photographs that have been taken in the last 40 years that symbolize for me the new horizons and understandings that we all need to incorporate into our vision of the world and our place in it. The first was taken on Christmas Eve, 1968, by the astronauts in the Apollo 8 spacecraft as it orbited around the moon. They turned their TV camera back on the Earth, and for the first time in history, the people of Earth saw their home as a small cloud-covered globe hanging in space, a jewel in an infinite ocean of black. That picture taught us in an instant that we are all one on this world, our only world, a tiny, fragile world for which we, and we alone on this planet, are the caretakers. There was no crystal dome over the earth separating our world from heaven, as those who wrote the Bible believed. There was no heaven in the blackness of the total vacuum of space. On hundreds of millions of television sets around the globe, all that the people saw was a fragile and altogether tiny world, a world put into perspective by the second photograph. The second photograph is called the Hubble Deep Field, and it was taken a few years ago by the Hubble Space Telescope. This photograph revealed thousands of galaxies and trillions of stars existing in an area of the sky no bigger than a grain of sand held at arm's length. The poets challenged us to imagine the world in a grain of sand. Well, here are trillions of them, an image so vast it is literally incomprehensible. When the Apollo 8 astronauts read from the book of Genesis on that Christmas Eve, it marked for me an important transition, a transition from the old myths, the old comforts, and the incredibly self-centered vision of humans and our planet to the new vision, with its very different place for us in the world, a natural place that was nonetheless fraught with responsibility and will require us to fearlessly, fairly, and honestly confront our future and the future of every living thing on this planet. Unfortunately, my youthful optimism has not been vindicated, at least not yet. I am a part of this church community and do these services in large part because I think that this transition from the old myths to the new reality is possibly the most important intellectual and spiritual transition a person can undergo, and it is going to take lots of us to change the world. And that, ultimately, is what asking the next question is about. It is about changing ourselves, our communities, and our world to make a better life for everyone. But before we can make changes, whether they are to ourselves as individuals or communities, or to our communities, we need to be able to envision those changes and then make them so. To do this, we must first and foremost change ourselves. This is the crucial first step. I would therefore wholeheartedly agree with the notion of self-work and trying to make ourselves better than we are and to increase our understanding of ourselves, our relationships, and our place in the world. In that sense, I am a firm believer in what is called positive psychology. Most psychology you hear about is concerned with fixing something, be it a phobia or neuroses or some other mental ailment. But there is much more possible in evolving and becoming a better, more understanding, and more complete human being than just correcting problems. Positive psychology is about finding ways for us to grow, to become more than we are, and to simply be better people. And one need not be lying on a couch for positive psychology to be a force in one's life. It can and does happen in the pews of this and other kindred churches and many other places as well. I will conclude by noting that virtually all choices we make about how to live our lives and what provides meaning and purpose are uncertain in the sense that we cannot be sure that this path or that path will lead to the best result or have any meaning except to ourselves. There are no certain paths to specific outcomes like happiness, success, meaning, and purpose. There is only our own path and the courage to go down it. My path has been the path of asking the next question and the question after that, and never stop asking questions. I am grateful to Theodore Sturgeon for introducing me to his queue with an arrow going through it on that snowy winter day so long ago. I chose that path, and it has made all the difference. So be it.